We would like to welcome you to the November 8th, 2023 meeting of the Savannah Historic District Board of Review. The purpose of this board is to promote the educational, cultural, economic, and general welfare of the city of Savannah. This board is appointed by City Council and is not affiliated with any for-profit or nonprofit organization. Preservation standards, visual compatibility factors, and design standards established in the City of Savannah zoning ordinance are the basis for evaluating the compatibility of changes and new development. The board cannot consider criteria not specifically identified within the ordinance. Items such as landscaping, parking availability, traffic, noise, and impact on property values are not within the board's purview and cannot be a factor in the issuance or denial of a certificate of appropriateness. Similarly, personal preferences will not be the basis for a decision. If you're joining us virtually, please make sure you're muted and locate your control panel and use the raise your hand feature. And if you're here with us, in person, please make sure that your cell phones are muted. Signed postings. Members of the board receive packages containing applications in the week before the meeting and individually visit the sites of the projects. If a project is not properly posted, it is removed from the agenda and rescheduled. Were there any projects that were not posted this month? Okay. Hearing none, we'll move on to the consent agenda. These items have been found by the preservation officer to be in accordance with the preservation standards, visual compatibility factors, and design standards, and have apparent consensus with no known objections from the public. Items on the consent agenda this month are, there are four of them, the petition of Catherine Murph, 23-004075-COA, 541 East Congress Street, alterations, the petition of Green Line Architecture, 23-005357-COA, 402 to 412 West Hall Street / 623 to 625 Montgomery Street fence. The petition of Lynch Architects 23-005361-COA, 570 Indian Street alterations. And lastly, the petition of Cook Architecture 23-005542-COA, 119 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard amendment. Is there any member of the public or any board member who wishes to remove an item from the consent agenda to the regular agenda? Okay. Hearing none, is there a motion for approval of the consent agenda?
Higgins, so moved.
Second.
Pumped. Good.
Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. With that, the items on the consent agenda have been approved. You are welcome to stay or leave as you wish. The adoption of the agenda. Is there a motion to adopt the agenda for today's meeting?
So moved. Stan.
Rowan, second.
Thank you. All opposed, please say, or all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. The minutes from the previous month's meeting are attached to the agenda. Is there a motion to approve the minutes from last month's meeting?
So moved.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
Thompson, second.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Again, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Okay. Items to be removed from the final agenda. There are none for this meeting, so we'll move on to the continued agenda. These applications have been requested to be continued to the following meeting. Those items are the petition of Webina Architects, 23-005347-COA, 409 West Taylor Street, New Construction Part 1. The petition of Sotil and Sotil, 23-004876-COA. 202 East Gwinnett Street, New Construction Small, Part 2, Design Details. The petition of Wakely Properties, LLC, 23-004866-COA. 520 East Oglethorpe Avenue, New Construction Part 2, Design Details. And the petition of Pantheon ADC, 23-005353-COA. 24 East Broughton Street Amendment. Is there a motion to continue the items on the continued agenda?
So moved.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Is there a second?
Rowan, second.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. And there were also no requests for extension this month either. So we'll move on to the regular agenda. Staff will present the application with a recommendation. The petitioner will then have the opportunity to respond to the recommendation. We ask that the petitioner limit their presentation to 10 minutes or less and only address items identified as inconsistent with the ordinance and questions raised by this board. The public will then have the opportunity to comment, after which the petitioner may respond to those public comments. The board will then go into board discussion, at which no further testimony is received unless specifically requested of and granted by the chairwoman. We will structure board discussion by going around to each board member two times for comment. If you don't have any comments, you do not have to provide any. If you're joining us virtually for the first time, please make sure that you use the raise your hand feature and I'll be notified and call on you by name. The first item on the regular agenda is the petition of Lomanac Coleman Smith Architects 23-004230-COA 208 East Liberty Street, new construction accessory building, part one, height and mass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Leah. The applicant is requesting approval for new construction, part one, height and mass for a two-story carriage house at the rear of the property located at 208 East Liberty Street. The rear of the property is currently an open parking area. The applicant is also requesting a variance recommendation request to the Zoning Board of Appeals for a variance from the standard that states the building footprint of the accessory dwelling unit shall be a maximum of 40% of the building footprint of the principal dwelling in order to allow the accessory dwelling unit footprint to be 48.3%. At the September meeting, the board continued the request in order for the petitioner to address the following five conditions: redesign the ground floor garage openings to meet the 12-foot maximum width standard and add garage doors. Two, redesign the frame construction of the second level to be masonry to meet the definition of true stucco in the ordinance. Three, the principal structure must be separated from the accessory dwelling unit by a minimum of 10 feet, provide a dimension, ensure that the standard is met. Four, the building footprint of the accessory dwelling unit must be a maximum of 40% of the building footprint. The principal dwelling, provide a calculation and ensure that the standard is met. Five, redesign the windows on the north facade to be more visually compatible. The block face along the lane consists of one contributing carriage house and one non-contributing carport. Historically, a wide variety of accessory buildings existed at the rear of this property. However, by the 1973 Sanborn map, the rear yard was vacant. Regarding the variance recommendation request and the variance criteria, the first criterion, general consistency. Per the applicant, carriage houses of the same general scale and size exist in the same block as the proposed carriage house, and it's visually compatible with the main dwelling on the site and its neighbors. It's consistent with the comprehensive plan and poses no detriment to the public health, safety, and welfare. Special conditions. For the applicant, unlike many sites within the district, this site, even with the additional structure, will have a lot coverage of only 65.7%, below the allowable coverage of 75%. Fortunately for the current owner, the original construction and later additions did not overbuild the site, leaving room for an additional 600 square foot structure, still without overbuilding the site. The circumstances are not purely financial in nature, but are consistent with the city's goal of providing more housing stock downtown and with the desire to complete the lanes with appropriately scaled structures. Literal interpretation criterion. Per the applicant, many other properties within the Landmark District have new and renovated carriage houses of a similar size that create a much higher percentage of lot coverage than the proposed, and the development or redevelopment of carriage houses along lanes is consistent with the historic downtown plan. To deny the owner the right to construct a carriage house of an appropriate size and scale would impose an undue hardship on the owner. Minimum variance criterion. Per the applicant, in response to the previous staff report, the applicant has revised the design to comply with the conditions stated in the cause of the continuance. Therefore, the variance is the minimum variance required. Special privilege not granted. Per the applicant is not seeking any special privilege and is only seeking to build a carriage house on a site that is consistent in scale, footprint, and design with other carriage houses in the same zoning district. With regard to visual compatibility and the rhythm of solids to voids, this is a rendering of the lane facade. This facade won't be seen if it faces interior to the property. The ground floor has been revised from one large opening without garage doors to one human door and two garage door openings. This and the rhythm of windows above are visually compatible. The rhythm of the porch projections. Although it's atypical to have balconies on lane facades in the visually related context, staff finds the Juliet balcony is appropriate because they do not project from the building as a typical balcony would. Staff is recommending to approve the request for new construction. Part one, height and mass, as requested because the proposed work is visually compatible and meets the standards, and approve a variance recommendation to the Zoning Board of Appeals for a variance from the standard that states the building footprint in the accessory dwelling unit shall be a maximum of 40% of the building footprint in the principal dwelling in order to allow the accessory dwelling unit footprint to be 48.3% because the variance criteria are met. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Does anybody have any questions for Leah?
Just very quick one. For clarification, the infill of the windows and the Juliet balcony railings will be included in part two?
I would go ahead and address them now if you have concerns about them. I mean, with the applicant.
Does anybody else have any questions for staff? Okay. Thank you, Leah.
Thank you.
Would the petitioner please come forward and state your name for the record?
Excuse me. I'm still trying to get used to walking with a cane. I'm Jerry Lominack, and needless to say, we do agree with the recommendations of staff. We've tried to address all the issues that were raised at the previous viewing. And I'll certainly be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Go ahead.
I have a quick question. Why are you adding the Juliet balconies?
There's an awfully nice view over to the park and then the cemetery. And being able to open that stand and look out, I think, is an awfully nice feature for the unit. Also, it does provide another access for fire department in case of fire. That's particularly true of the sleeping room, bedroom. And I personally have had a situation like that on my own in a house that I had, no longer do have, but did have. And it's nice to be able to walk, open a door and breathe the fresh air and sort of feel like you're outside. So that was really the reason.
What's the projection?
It's applied to the face. It sticks out just
inches.
Inches, yes.
Any other questions for the applicant?
Yes. Along those same lines, is there some reason you use the applied Juliet balcony as opposed to putting one within
the applied? I did what? I'm sorry.
Is there some reason or necessity that you had the applied Juliet balcony that's applied to the exterior of the wall as opposed to just having one that goes within the doorway opening?
You know, it really could go within the doorway opening. So I don't. Somehow, you sort of expect a balcony like that to overlap the sides. I think that would be the normal way you would see it. Functionally, it could certainly work within the recess of the windows for the door.
And the other question I have is about the window infill, the lower half. Is there some function to that, or?
It's just a wood panel. A decorative wood panel.
Any additional questions? Go ahead, Mr. Holt.
On the request for the variance, I assume that you supplied the information to staff, and there was something in there about an undue hardship if the 48% the 8% over what's allowed was not granted. Can you give a little bit more definition as to what hardship is?
Well, I think that particular part actually asked for covered a little bit more than just hardship. I think it was financial hardship.
Was the hardship financial in nature? Is that what the premise is?
Not really. It's just that to have a dwelling unit that is a nice livable and rentable unit, it's hard to get it in less than 600 square feet. And in this particular case, this house, its footprint, although it's a large, it's a three-story house, its footprint is not as large as it could be. If the house was a little bigger, that could be bigger. I'll put it that way. So, and we're still able to maintain more open space than the ordinance requires.
Does that answer your question? Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Quinn.
Sorry, just a clarification point. If the variance is granted and you get the 48%, can you tell us what the total lot coverage would be with the main dwelling unit and the accessory unit?
Around 65% instead of 70%.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions for the applicant? Okay, thank you. Is there a member of the public that would like to speak on this item? Make sure you state your name for the record.
I'll be happy to do that. My name is John Tatum. I know some of you know me. And I live in the house at the Abercorn Street end of this block, which is the western block that we're talking about here. It's in the petitioner's exhibits. This is a 10-building block. There is an existing carriage house in this block at the eastern end. This petitioner's property is the third house from the Abercorn Street, the western end, mm-hmm. The completely opposite. The staff's findings say that carriage houses of the same general scale and size do exist in the same block, but they don't. There's one, and it exists down in isolation on the eastern end. Now, the eastern end is Lincoln Street, so this is a block between Lincoln Street and Abercorn Street on East Liberty Street, and the lane in the rear, which is called Perry Lane. Two buildings, as I say, the existing carriage house is the third house from Lincoln Street, going back to the west. As Mr. Lomanac has said, the views are unusual in this block because the front view, we don't have other, normally you would see other residences. We don't have that. We have a school. We have St. Vincent's Academy. Looking out the back of your house, the houses, and they're all single family residence houses with one exception. Well, two now, because we now have an STVR. And I will talk about that in a little bit. But the house at the end is residential, but it could be multi-family residential. The rest of them are single-family residents. Out in the back, as Mr. Lomanac has described, you have a beautiful view, all these houses do, of the Colonial Cemetery, looking over Perry Street. And even before the Colonial Cemetery, there's a park directly behind my house. There are two or three benches there. People use it. People use those benches during the day. People have lunch sitting there. And then there's a green field all the way down across what would be Lincoln Street if it were to continue through the Colonial Cemetery. So what we have is that we have this unusual block of single-family residences primarily, overwhelmingly. The subject property was a single family residence. The owner died in probate. It was sold to the present owner, who operates a short-term vacation rental, STVR, there. And now, but this proposed two-story carriage house is not visually compatible with its neighbors, not with its neighbors. I think the petitioner's exhibits made a clear showing of what that massive structure in appearance would be if one were walking in the lane behind the houses, or if one were walking south on Abercorn Street approaching Perry Lane. You would see we have no existing accessory buildings west of the existing carriage house that is there today. But that's the only existing carriage house. Going all the way seven houses to Abercorn, there are no two-story structures, no accessory buildings.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your comments because you're at 4 minutes already.
And my time is five?
It was three, but I'll give you five.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I do want to go on, move on to the variance, because this point has been talked about. There are two requirements, size and footprint requirements, that apply to this accessory building. And that is, first of all, the 40% requirement. It cannot exceed 40% of the footprint of the primary structure. And it also cannot exceed 75% with the primary structure of the lot. Now, they want a variance. And the only thing that they can tell you about unreasonable harm is that they're not taking up 75% of the lot. And so, therefore, they make the conclusion that they can get a variance of the other requirement. Those two requirements are independent of one another. They have to meet both requirements. Thank you.
Anybody else from the public like to make a comment? Come on. Make sure you state your name for the record.
Certainly. Yes, this is Andrew Jones. I'm chair of the Oglethorpe Plant Coalition. And I just want to reiterate that the visual compatibility test requires that this proposal be visually compatible with specific contributing buildings to which it visually relates, which means buildings that can be seen from the subject property. And this staff recommendation, like many we see, doesn't actually cite the specific buildings that we're alluding to. We don't see pictures of them. It's just kind of a throwaway. And this is a very serious responsibility to determine whether this is visually compatible with specific buildings or not. And as with many proposals, I don't think you've been provided the information necessary to actually make that analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Come on.
Hi, I'm Bill Campbell. My wife, Diane, and I recently moved into the adjoining property, 204 East Liberty Street. We've been there a few months. We are opposed to the COA and to the STVR certificates issued as well, although I understand this commission does not govern it. However, we think it's very different than the other houses that adjoin. I've actually spoken to almost all of the neighbors, and myself and Pete Connolly sent emails in to this commission. I do not know if you've had time to read them. We sent them yesterday, as well as John Tatum. But we think that it visually, it's not going to be the same at all with what is out there right now. It's also going to destroy the privacy of the adjoining courtyards, myself and the Connollys. We're very opposed to the way the STVR certificates were issued, because they've issued two certificates for a two-unit dwelling. And this block is zoned for owner-occupied STVRs only. So there apparently seems to be no difference now between what is owner-occupied and non-owner-occupied. There is no place for the owner to live, in other words. Now they're going to build a third unit, obviously to increase the rental footprint, and we have no idea if the owner will be present in any of these or for how long. So we wanted to come down and voice our opposition to it. We think it's a bad move, and it's not been properly investigated. And we think that somehow there has been a change in the way that the STVR office is interpreting what it means to be an owner-occupant. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to address something that you said, we don't have any regulation over STVRs or use or anything like that. So just so you know, that doesn't apply to us at all. We don't have any governance over any of that.
I did say.
Yeah. I'm just clarifying that you're, yeah, that we don't.
I understand that, but I think that the issues are so related to each other.
If you're going to come up, just come. Record and all that, you know?
Yeah. I think that the two issues are related to each other. The STVRs and the COAs, and even though you don't govern that part of it, mm-hmm. they go in hand together so that you'll understand what's going on. It has become a virtual revolving door of tenants, and I have yet to see the owner ever.
Yeah. Thank you. Anybody else from the public like to make any comments?
Thank you and good afternoon. My name is Steve Edwards and I represent the Downtown Neighborhood Association, and we would like to state our opposition to the request for variance in this case. We have two basic concerns which echo what have already been articulated. One is the appropriateness for an oversized carriage house on this lane. And it's in our concern, in addition, again, what's already been said is not just that it's visually, not visually compatible with other structures that can be seen from this structure, but also this particular lane is different from most lanes. Most lanes are, have structures on both sides. In this case, there'll never be a structure, presumably, on the other side. So it's much more visual, visually accessible from, the public's access. So I think you need to be especially careful with a structure that's always going to be facing the public. And of course, as you know, the site that it faces is one of our most important historical sites, the Colonial Cemetery. The other concern that we have relates to the STVR aspect, and I acknowledge, as those others did, that you don't have anything to do with that, and I'm sure you're thankful for that. The point here, though, is that one of the our point is that the criteria for a variance have not been met, and specifically, one of the conditions is that special conditions or circumstances are therefore purely financial in nature so as to allow the applicant to use the land, buildings, or structures involved more profitably. This is not an owner-occupied structure. The sole purpose for getting the variance is to increase the rental income from it. And therefore, we believe that that one criteria to defeat the variance has been met, and therefore you should not approve it. I think it's disingenuous at best to say that it's increasing the housing stock downtown because there's no evidence that it will be used for anything other than a short-term vacation rental. We're therefore strongly opposed to the variance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else from the public that would like to comment? Is there anybody virtually?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Nobody else? Okay. Would the petitioner like to respond to the public comments?
Yes, I would. The one thing, the original historic portion of the existing house is in fact brick. For some reason, even its neighbor, they share a wall, is stuccoed over, and the brick on this house was painted. I couldn't tell you why or when. Also, carriage houses historically existed, I think, on all of those properties up until, I think it was early 60s. Do you recall, Leah?
They did.
Okay. Yeah, I think so. Let's see.
I was trying to find it quickly, but
until this is the 66 map. So
up through 66, there were carriage houses mm-hmm. on all of these properties. There was a rash of carriage houses that got torn down about that time to provide off-street parking behind houses. In fact, the house that we live in, one block east of this across the street, it was been in my family, my wife's family for several generations, had a carriage house that they tore down as part of the Troop Border of a Renewal Area project. Mm-hmm. and got paid to do it. So to rebuild carriage houses along the lane is, in fact, historically the appropriate thing to do. And I'm not even going to talk about how, I mean, we'd have designed an apartment, a carriage house apartment with parking below it. And the, how the owner chooses to rent it has not been a part of our decision making on this. We think that to have the amount of open space that the property still maintains, even though it is a little larger than if the house was bigger. In fact, we could meet the 75% lot coverage and do this same size building if the house footprint was just a little bigger. But still, it's a three-story house. So scale-wise, I think it does reflect the intent of the ordinance. As I said, the original house is brick. I mean, the historic portion of the original house. In fact, the brick is still unpainted on the western side. It's only painted on the front. I don't know why. And people who get to look out on that park will still be able to look out to the park and the playground. I'm very familiar with that park because it was my wife's and the cemetery was my wife's playground when she was growing up as a little girl on Liberty Street. We think we've complied with the criteria that the review board established at the last meeting, and have addressed all of those particular issues. And we feel like that the variance, considering the fact that we're still maintaining a greater open space, and are using the same materials that the historic building was built out of, certainly makes it compatible, and the proportions of the windows in relationship solids to voids and all that is certainly in compliance. Heights restrictions in compliance, and by right, a person can build a carriage house on that site. I think that's all, unless somebody else has a question.
I don't think so. Thank you, Jerry. Okay. At this time, we're now going to enter into board discussion, and no further comment will be accepted. We're going to be into board discussion now. Mr. Hull, go ahead.
A question for Leah before I say anything else. Whatever we do, there's two things on here. Is this two motions, or yeah, can we include everything in one motion?
You can do it either way.
Okay.
You can say, you know, and like I've written,
and,
or okay, you can separate. Right.
You just need a decision for each item.
Yeah.
Just wanted the technical part. I guess my issue goes back to what I raised earlier about the 48%, and how that exceeds the requirement in the ordinance. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen any justification presented to go above the 40%.
Okay, Ms. Gwynn.
I agree. I agree with my colleague's comments. And I also think it's important to listen to the comments from the neighbors and the properties that will be affected, and to their comments on how we assess visual compatibility. I think it's important to keep that to the block that we're looking at and discussing, and also take into consideration that this is kind of a special block and lane.
Mr. Higgins.
I echo prior two comments and have some real concerns with the variance. When mm-hmm. I hear from the applicant that the main justification is because it's the only way to have a rentable unit.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not in favor of the variance.
Mr. Thompson.
I have a question concerning the short-term vacation rental.
We can't determine use.
Which we can't. But right. Is there currently a permit for this house with that? Anybody know?
It doesn't.
Okay. All right.
We can't take that into consideration.
No, I know we can't, but it was a question raised by the commenters, and whether it's correct or not should be understood.
Ms. Taylor.
I was going to ask Leah, can we take a look at that diagram again? No, the one that's on the table, isn't that the model? Yeah. Sorry. I think it gives a good representation. I agree with what my colleagues have said so far. I think within the context of this block, it seems that this carriage house is overbuilt. I don't think they meet the criteria for the variance as well. And
we'll relook at this one more time.
Yes, one more time, just to look at that. And that pretty much summarizes my comments.
Ms. Roan?
No comment.
Mr. Becker?
First of all, I'd like to thank the applicant for the changes that he did make for the improvements from the last time we were here. It doesn't go unrecognized. However, when you look at what they're asking for, is not only is it we're asking for two things here, but they're tied together, even though it's an and, is the variance. In order to get a variance, you have.
Is your mic on? I'm sorry.
It should be.
Okay.
Am I speaking into it?
Yeah.
My concern rests with the variance. I think we need to be particularly careful and follow guidelines when we're agreeing to variances. And unfortunately, I don't think that the hurdles that are required in order to approve a variance have been met in this case.
Okay. We'll go around a second time. Mr. Hull. Ms. Gwynn.
Nothing further.
Mr. Higgins.
Just one quick thing, which will be part two, but I do have concerns with the Juliet balconies and the window infill.
Okay. Mr. Thompson?
No comment.
Ms. Taylor?
And I agree, too. I, too, have an issue with the visual compatibility of the Juliet balconies.
Okay. Ms. Rowan?
No comment.
Mr. Becker?
Nothing additional.
Okay. I'm going to provide my own comments. I don't disagree that there were once, carriage houses on this block or on this site. And I think that the building of that is warranted. However, I also agree with my colleagues as far as the variance situation not being met. And like you said, maybe overbuilt. And that's all I'm going to say. So at this time, we will now entertain a motion.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that the Savannah Downtown Historic Board of Review approve the petition 2300423 COA for new construction part one height and mass at 208 East Liberty Street because the property proposed work is visually compatible and meets the definitions. And however, I further move that the board disapprove the variance recommendation to the Zoning Board of Appeals. And I'll leave it at that.
I don't think that's a valid motion because I don't think you can approve one and deny the other. Right?
I mean,
because how can you approve the mass and scale, the height and scale of one if you're going to deny the variance, which would allow it to be that size
and scale? Good point. Yeah.
So I'm going to have to,
I need
you to amend
your
motion.
I will amend my motion.
Okay.
Since you said I can't do it. I move that the Savannah Downtown Historic Board of Review deny the petition 2300423 COA, height and mass 208 East Liberty, and further deny the variance recommendation.
Okay, reasonings as to why you're denying.
Excuse me?
I need you to outline the reasons why you're denying.
Because the denial of the request for the variance is based, at least from what I heard, on financial considerations.
Yeah, I would say I need you to look at your binder, your thing, and restate your motion for me. I need you to restate all of that.
Okay.
as to why you're denying.
Huh? Yeah.
Has to be clear as to why.
All right. I move that the Savannah Downtown Historic Board of Review deny petition 23004230 COA based on incompatibility of the project as outlined in the staff report.
But it's not outlined in the staff report.
I was recommending approval.
Right.
May I take a crack?
Do you want to try or do you want to take your motion off the floor?
I will remove my motion.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'll now entertain a new motion.
Okay.
Thank you.
I move that the Savannah Downtown Historic Board of Review deny petition 23004230 COA 208 East Liberty Street based on the incompatibility of the project due to design standards that the building exceeds 40% of the primary building footprint.
And?
Without showing practical difficulty or undue hardship for the variance.
What's your decision on the variance? You want to deny the variance as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay, can you state that?
And deny the variance because it does not provide any evidence of supporting the undue, any hardship. How's that?
Good. Okay. Do I have a second on that motion?
Higgins, second.
Thank you, Higgins. Okay.
Can we repeat that?
Yes. So to repeat that motion, made by Mr. Becker, we're denying the request for the new construction part one height and mass, due to the incompatibility of design standards, of height and mass and to deny the variance due to, the hardship criteria not being met. And that was seconded by Mr. Higgins. Okay. Mr. Houle, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Gwynn?
Aye.
Mr. Higgins?
Aye.
Mr. Thompson?
Aye.
Was that an aye?
That was an aye.
Okay. Ms. Taylor?
Aye.
Ms. Rowan?
Aye.
And Mr. Becker?
Aye.
Okay. With that, the petition has been denied and the variance request has also been denied. Okay. The next item on the regular agenda is the petition of James Burnsid, 23-005047-COA, 36 Whitaker Street, illuminated sign. Design standard is still the same. Yes, I can write it out for you. It's very close.
Did someone leave a pair of reading glasses up here?
Caitlin, they're his.
Hey, how did you see
them? All right.
Hey, go ahead.
We're ready.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. The applicant is requesting approval for the installation of an illuminated projecting sign for the business located at 36 Whitaker Street. 36 Whitaker Street was built in 1851 and is a contributing resource. It is one of many businesses within the ground floor of the building, which covers both Whitaker and West Congress Streets. The official address of the building is 31 West Congress. Staff found many of the standards for projecting sign were met and that the black and white color scheme was neutral and would be similar in design to that of the neighboring business's sign at Bar Bubbly, except that it would be internally rather than externally illuminated. When the applicant first submitted their sign, it was black lettering with a white background, but after discussing with staff, the applicant was amenable to reversing the sign colors to an opaque black background where only the white lettering would be illuminated in order to meet the ordinance. Upon further review of section 9.960 of the sign ordinance, it states that enclosed lamp, neon, or exposed fluorescent lighting shall not be permitted within any residential district or across the street from any residential use. DCBD is not a residential district, but after discussing with the city zoning administrator, it was determined that there are residences directly across the street on the upper levels on the building that houses Kay's Pizza. This conversation took place after the staff report was written, which included the condition that if part of the second story of the building across the street was residential, to change the illumination to external, similar to what is seen at 38 Whitaker Street. The applicant has since stated they are agreeable to changing the illumination to two external low-voltage LED lamps that face the sign and reversing the color scheme to a white background with black lettering. This discussion occurred after the staff report was published, and thus the staff recommendation remains to approve the illuminated projecting sign for the business located at 36 Whitaker Street with the following condition to be submitted to staff for final review and approval because the work is otherwise visually compatible and meets the standards. If it is determined that there are residential units facing 36 Whitaker Street at the building across the street, that the applicant changes the sign to becoming externally illuminated. Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin. Does anybody have any questions for staff? Go ahead. Make sure you say your name before you talk to.
Todd Thompson.
Yeah.
In our pre-meeting, it was discussed the potential for external illumination.
Yes.
And the original sign was proposed to be black letter with white background. If they put the external lighting, is that an option?
Well, if they wanted to keep it.
Pardon me?
If they wanted to keep it.
If they not internally illuminated, but yeah, externally.
So what they're planning to do is like what this one has done here, where yeah, there's just those two little lights kind of facing the sign.
Okay, I guess the question is, can they go back to their original design?
Yes, and that's what their plan is, to go back to the white with the black lettering.
Okay, thank you. That was my question.
Any other questions for staff? Thank you, Caitlin.
Yeah.
Would the petitioner like to come forward? Didn't think they were here. Okay. Is there a member of the public that would like to comment? Is anybody virtual? No?
No.
Okay. At this time, we'll now go into board discussion then. Mr. Poole.
No comment.
Ms. Gwynn.
Just a question so we don't get hung on the way the motion is made.
Yes.
Since what we're being asked to approve is the illuminated sign and not the externally lit sign, procedurally, what would be the correct thing to do? Deny it or... Because we would be changing what we're approving.
Yeah, that's a good question, considering the other stuff was submitted after the fact. That's a good question.
And the condition is, like, they changed it to what the condition already said. It's not something different than what the condition is asking. So.
Okay. So you just would approve with the condition?
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Mr. Higgins.
No comment.
And Mr. Thompson.
Tom Thompson.
Thank you.
I typically am not in favor of taking action on something the applicant's not here, but in this case, I can support that.
Okay. Ms. Taylor?
No comment.
Ms. Rowan?
I mean, with them doing the illuminated sign.
Make sure you speak into the microphone.
With them doing the illuminated sign, is it creating even more light than just having the two lights shine on the – that's what – I mean, isn't arguably, it providing the same amount of light?
Arguably, it's more focused.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Mr. Becker?
No comments.
Okay. I'll go around a second time just to make sure. Mr. Higgins? Ms. Gwynn?
Nothing further.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cole. I said Mr. I'm sorry. Mr. Higgins?
No further comments.
Mr. Thompson?
Okay, let's clarify what the staff recommendation or current situation is. So it's for externally illuminated
yes,
sign with white background and black lettering.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay,
yes.
So everybody, same page.
Ms. Taylor.
Nothing further.
Ms. Rowan.
Nothing further.
Mr. Becker.
Nothing further.
Okay, at this time, we will now entertain a motion.
Higgins. I move the Savannah Historic District Board of Review approve the petition of petition 23-005047 COA to approve the illuminated projecting sign for the business located at 36 Whitaker Street with the following condition to be submitted to staff for final review and approved because the work is otherwise visually compatible and meets the standard. The condition is, one, if it is determined that there are residential units facing 36 Whitaker Street at the building across the street, the applicant changes the sign to become externally illuminated.
Okay, do I have a second on that motion?
Second, Taylor.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Okay, the current motion on the floor is to approve with the condition as outlined in the staff recommendation, and that's seconded by Ms. Taylor. Mr. Houle, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Gwynn?
Aye.
Mr. Higgins?
Aye.
Ms. Thompson?
Aye.
Ms. Taylor?
Aye.
Ms. Rowan?
Aye.
And Mr. Becker?
Aye.
Okay. With that, the petition has been approved with conditions. Number 13 is the petition of Smoke and Vape Market, 23-005306-COA, 107 West Congress Street, signage.
Thank you. This is Caitlin again. So for this case at 107 West Congress Street, the applicant is requesting after-the-fact approval for the installation of one non-illuminated window sign and one illuminated incidental open sign for the business located at 107 West Congress Street. 107 West Congress is a non-contributing resource. It is along a block of Congress Street that is surrounded by many commercial buildings. From a collection of photos in the MPC archives, a portion of the former historic building may still be intact, but the facade was heavily altered to the appearance that it is seen today. 107 West Congress Street is far from the only business in the vicinity with illuminated open signs. Other businesses include B&D Burgers, Twisted Sugar, The Salt Table, The Chicken Box, Madam Butterfly, and The Octane Bar, to name a few. With regard to the visual compatibility, the standards are met. The window sign is an applied decal with a black background, which balances the brighter colors of the lettering. Since this is relatively small in comparison to the storefront, it does not overpower the predominantly glass storefront area, nor the portion of Congress Street where a myriad of sign types exist in this section. Regarding the incidental sign, illumination is permitted, and the colors match with other illuminated open signs on contributing buildings throughout the area. The sign also takes up a small portion of the storefront glazing. Staff found that the standards for the special sign districts were met. This includes the city's zoning administrator's determination that the open sign is an incidental sign and the decal is a window sign. And other neon signs displayed in the windows were considered promotional window signs, which are not permitted in the downtown historic district and will be removed. Incidental signs in the CBD zoning districts cannot exceed 4 square feet. And if any other signage is proposed within the area, the total cannot exceed 9 square feet. The incidental sign is 17 inches by 33 inches, which is 3.78 square feet, and the window sign is 24 inches in diameter, or 3.14 square feet. The standard is met because the aggregate sign area is 6.92 square feet, which is under 9 square feet as noted above. Additionally, the approximate square footage on the windows of the front facade, which is made up almost entirely of glazing, is 120 square feet. Signs in windows cannot exceed 10% of this window area, which would be 10 square feet, so it's also under the 10%. With that, staff approves the after-the-fact installation of one non-illuminated window sign and one illuminated incidental open sign for the business located at 107 West Congress Street as requested because the signs are visually compatible and meet the standards. Thanks. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Caitlin. Does anybody have any questions for staff? Okay, thank you. Would the petitioner like to comment? I don't think they're here.
I don't know if anybody.
Are they virtual?
No, I'm,
I'm a virtual member. I don't have any comment. Thank you.
Okay. Is there a member of the public that would like to comment? Okay. Then at this time, we'll now go into board discussion. Mr. Becker, I'll start with you.
Thank you. Look, at the Savannah sign ordinance states that its intent is to encourage the aesthetically pleasing, appropriate scale, and integrated with surrounding buildings. I don't believe that the montage of signs that are in this is actually is appropriate in scale. And I know we're going to be talking that we're going to be removing three of those, which are out of compliance. So I'm going to just limit my comments to be the appropriate colors, not being visually related for the open sign. A lot of the comments that were made earlier reference other open signs, but I contend that probably those have not been approved. And number two, if you look at visually related on the signs that are on this street, there are no multicolored open signs. And I would suggest that if the board were to approve this, that we would focus on the color of the open sign and limit it to a soft white open sign. And these signs are readily available and inexpensive, and that that would be a consideration as a condition for approval.
Okay. Ms. Rowan.
I agree with the previous comments.
Okay. Ms. Taylor.
I agree as well as far as the colors. Nothing more.
Okay. Mr. Thompson. Okay. Mr. Higgins.
I agree with the previous comments and just want to add in my displeasure of having to deal with after the fact installations.
Yeah. Ms. Gwynn.
No comments.
And Mr. Hull.
No comment.
Okay. I'll go around one more time just because Mr. Becker had comments primarily the first time. Do you have any additional?
No comments.
Okay. Ms. Rowan.
No additional comments.
Ms. Taylor.
Nothing.
Okay. Mr. Thompson.
No comments. No.
Okay. Mr. Higgins.
No additional.
Ms. Gwynn.
None.
And Mr. Hull.
Nothing.
Okay. At this time, we will now entertain a motion.
I would like to make a motion.
Okay.
I move that the Savannah Downtown Historical Board approve petition 23005306 COA 107 West Congress Street, conditioned upon the illuminated sign be limited to exclusively a white illuminated sign. In order to be visually related.
Okay. Okay. So the current motion on the floor made by Mr. Becker is to approve with the condition that the signage be limited to white in order to be visually compatible. Are you referring to the light of the, like the temperature of the light? The color of the light, the temperature of the light. Okay. Okay, so let me restate that one more time. Made by Mr. Becker to approve upon the condition that the temperature of the light be limited to white in order to be more visually compatible. Do I have a second on that?
Gwynn, second.
Thank you, Ms. Gwynn. Okay, Mr. Becker, how do you vote?
Yes.
Ms. Rowan? Ms. Taylor?
Yes.
Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
Mr. Higgins?
Yes.
Ms. Gwynn?
Yes.
And Mr. Hull?
Yes.
Okay. The next item on the regular agenda is the petition of Bethany Ralph, 23-004871-COA, 424 Habersham Street, after the fact fence and gate.
Trying to find which one it is. All right. Here we go. The applicant is requesting approval of an after-the-fact fence installation and also construction of two brick columns to support a set of antique wooden gates for the property located at 424 Habersham Street. So just to show, this was the previous submittal from last month, and these are existing conditions.
That's just something surrounding in the neighborhood that's similar. So 424 Habersham Street was built in 1896 and is a contributing resource within the National Historic Landmark District and the Savannah Downtown Historic District. It's a two-story wood frame house on a truss lot facing Whitfield Square. There's a very similar house directly next door on the truss lot, 426 Habersham Street. There are several other wood frame structures in the vicinity. The applicant made an in-kind fence replacement without a COA based on the Google Street View photos between 2012 and 2022. This can be verified that the new fence was placed in the same location as the old one. In the older photos, there's a small storage shed built in the same place as the plane as the fence. It was highly overgrown with vines, but there is concrete block beneath the foliage. Where there had been a shingle roof, it does look like the applicant had added some height. However, this was an existing condition, and the applicant has stated that there was no permit required for this because the shed is only 25 square feet and less than one story in height. The applicant also proposed to include the brick columns and two antique wooden gates. Previously included with the work was the addition of two stone griffins to be placed atop the brick columns. But since the last HDBR meeting, the applicant has since withdrawn this element as part of the project. Staff found that the fence, brick columns, and gates could all be removed in the future without affecting the historic building, and the project elements do not physically affect the historic building in a way that would negatively alter the building materials. The applicant also submitted a scale dimensions drawing with measurements that clarifies the height of each element, which is shown currently. They've also provided a brick sample. I'll just show here. This brick is obviously reclaimed brick. The plan is to use this. It matches the painted brick on the foundation piers, but this is obviously not going to be painted. Those were the conditions that were required. There was a third condition that was about providing more information about those stone griffins, but that has been withdrawn. With regard to the relationship of a wood fence and wood gates with a set of brick columns, since the historic house is a wood frame house with a brick foundation, the combination of these materials is visually compatible with the building. The applicant provided an unpainted brick sample that closely matches. The paint on the gates is worn away in various parts, but the beige color, let me get that back up. The beige color of the main parts of the gates and the red outlines of the gate panels would be compatible with the light colored wood of the fence, which a stain will be applied to, and the brick. The fence location was an existing condition for the property. Upon staff inspection, it appears that the applicant placed the fence within the same area that the earlier fence had been. Staff noticed on site that the reasoning for the placement of the older fence was likely to stay aligned with the end of the house, where if it were moved back from the neighboring building facade, the fence would end up at the center of the rear porch and balcony. There is also not 5 feet between the properties where the fence is parallel. So with that, staff recommends to approve the after-the-fact fence installation and proposed installation of brick columns and antique wood gates for the property located at 424 Habersham Street as requested because the work is visually compatible and meets the standards. Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin. Does anybody have any questions for staff?
I have one quick one. Would we need to include some language about painting or staining the fence in recommendations?
We could. The applicant has agreed to do so, and they've provided the product information that they'll be using. But should the board feel comfortable including that, you'd be welcome to do so.
Any additional questions for staff? Okay, thank you. Would the petitioner like to come forward? Make sure you state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Bethany Ralph. I'm the applicant. I appreciate the consideration that staff has given to my application and the consideration of the board. I agree with staff's conclusions and hope you'll approve the application.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for the applicant? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to comment virtually?
No, ma'am.
In person? No? Wow. Okay. Then at this time, we will now enter into board discussion. Mr. Becker, I'll start with you.
I have no comments.
Ms. Rowan?
No comment.
Ms. Taylor?
I will say I appreciate the removal of the griffins. And it looks like everything else looks compatible.
Mr. Thompson?
No comment.
Mr. Higgins?
No comment.
Ms. Quinn?
No comment.
And Mr. Hull?
I just confirm what was mentioned in the previous application that we have presented to us and again after the fact submission.
Okay, since nobody really had anything to say the first time around, we will now entertain a motion.
Higgins?
Yes.
I move the Savannah Historic District Board of Review approve the petition of 23-004871 COA for the after-the-fact fence installation and the proposed installation of brick columns and antique wooden gates for the property located at 424 Habersham Street as requested because the work is otherwise visually compatible and meets standards with one condition and that the fence be painted or stained.
Thompson, ooh. Second.
Second.
Okay, so the current motion on the floor is to approve the application as submitted with the single condition to for the wood fence to be painted or stained and seconded by Mr. Thompson. Mr. Becker, how do you vote?
Yes.
Ms. Rowan?
Aye.
Ms. Taylor?
Aye.
Mr. Thompson, sorry.
Aye.
Mr. Higgins?
Aye.
Ms. Gwen?
Aye.
And Mr. Poole?
Aye.
Sorry, I am apparently very tongue-twisted today, so you guys will just have to bear with me. Okay, with that, the application has been approved with the single condition. Next item on the regular agenda is the petition of Shed Architecture 23-005415-COA, 414 MLK Jr. Boulevard, non-contributing demolition.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Caitlin again. The applicant is requesting approval to demolish the non-contributing building at 414 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The original construction date of the structure located at 414 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard is unknown, but is listed as a non-contributing resource within the National Historic Landmark District and the local Savannah Downtown Historic District. The Sanborn Fire Insurance map from 1888 shows two attached one-story wood frame dwellings at the site of 414 West Broad Street. In 1898, 414 West Broad Street is not shown as an address, but there are four attached two-story wood-frame dwellings that fronted on Berrien Street, with the end of the row adjacent to the corner of West Broad Street. Changes to the building began to appear starting with the 1916 Sanborn map, where only one of the original four Berrien Street-facing houses reads as a dwelling unit. The other three were incorporated into a two-story store building facing West Broad Street as 414A and 414B West Broad. Also by this time, a brick facade was added to the first story, whereas the bay windows still appear from the other three houses. The configuration was in place until the 1973 Sanborn map, which shows the bay windows gone, the last remaining of the four houses incorporated into the rest of the modified building, and an expansion that allowed for there to be connecting interior wall between it and 412 West Broad Street. There were still addresses noted on the Berrien Street side. Photographs from the 1940s and up through the 60s reflect what is seen on the Sanborn maps with the commercial business on the street level and residential units above. Later photographs that extend beyond the end of the local period of significance of 1960 show further alterations to the building. So just kind of visual timeline on pictures we have located. The Savannah Ward notebook for the Berrien Ward has a note to omit 414 West Broad Street, but a reason is not given. This page does not include much detail about the structure, except to note it has a vague construction date of 20th century. Based on the Sanborn maps and historic photographs, it's likely the building was not noted as contributing because of the array of alterations it's undergone even beyond the period of significance. Two structural reports were conducted for 414 MLK Boulevard, the first on December 10th, 2018, and more recently on July 18th of 2023. The December 2018 report was undertaken by Tharp Engineering Group. The report makes note of issues such as unsupported framing, major termite damage, major water damage, inadequate bearing conditions, fire damage, failure in the floor decking, deflected beams and girders, deteriorated brick mortar, and major brick repairs required. Just to kind of go through these photos that were included with that report. Some recommendations to stabilize and repair the building included reconstructing the slope second floor framing on the north wall in order to stabilize the framing system, resolving the truss deflections and bearing issues, as the report stated that additional deterioration could initiate a complete failure. The report also noted if left unaddressed, the unsupported framing presents a potential life safety hazard with a failure of the floor system. There was a recommendation to immediately address the fire and water damage at the front corner of the building. The structural report from July 18th of 2023 was undertaken by F. Michael Sykes, structural engineer. This report noted similar issues such as severe brick cracking in the brick masonry walls, mortar failure, severe deflections of the second floor framing system, fire and water damage, insufficient bearing and insect damage. The report's recommendation was as follows. Based on the condition of the existing building framing system and the extent of repairs required to make this building functional, it is my professional opinion this building should be demolished and rebuilt. Just jumping ahead to the background on the historic building map, which had been part of the inquiry previous times this was presented. The Savannah National Historic Landmark District was originally surveyed in 1966. In 1973, the Savannah Zoning Ordinance was adopted. This section established the Historic District Board of Review and created the Historic Buildings Map. All structures within the historic district were divided into two classes, historic and non-rated. Historic structures included all those buildings listed in Historic Savannah, the architectural survey book published by Historic Savannah Foundation in 1968. In 1985, an MPC staff study was adopted and the historic buildings map was amended to include all those buildings listed in the 1979 second edition of Historic Savannah, as well as those buildings identified by a consultant working on behalf of the National Park Service. NPS had extended the period of significance for contributing buildings to 1935. Demolition of a non-rated historic structure in the 500 block of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and the attempted demolition of a non-rated historic cottage in the Beach Institute neighborhood spurred the updating of the historic buildings map. In April 2000 and September 2000, the mayor and aldermen approved the addition of a number of buildings previously omitted from the map and the eastern and western neighborhoods of the historic district. On April 20th of 2000, the building map was amended to include buildings on MLK Boulevard and Montgomery Street, and the period of significance was extended locally to 1950. City Council minutes from the April 20th, 2000 meeting provide details of every building that was proposed to be added. Several of these are 20th century commercial buildings on MLK Boulevard, ranging from the 0 block through the 700 block, where only one from the 400 block was proposed, and that was 406. The buildings recommended for listing cover categories of significance such as 20th century commerce, local commerce, architecture, neighborhood business with living quarters above, early commerce on MLK, early 20th century business development of MLK, overall business development of the historic district, structures built by African American developers and Black heritage. Again, in 2010, the historic building map was updated to include 112 new structures, and at no time of any of these was 414 Martin Luther King Boulevard noted to be added as a contributing resource. So, before a non-contributing building can be approved for demolition, it must be evaluated as a potential contributing resource. There are two sets of criteria. The first is the contributing resource status, and the second is exceptional importance. For exceptional importance, contributing, to be considered contributing, these resources must possess integrity of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. In addition to that, they must meet one or more of the above criteria of the contributing resources. So just to go through some of these, for integrity of location, the integrity of the location was compromised when the portion of Berrien Street was demolished for the I-16 flyover. For design, the integrity of the design of the original Italianate townhouses was first compromised when the hybrid commercial and residential space was altered, as first seen on the 1916 Sanborn map. Over several decades, the building changed multiple times, from the removal of the bay windows of the original houses, the addition of steel industrial windows, and subsequent ceiling of said windows, addition of a commercial storefront, and later changes to its location. Transom Lights advertising the pawn shop to be completely covered in stucco. The interior spaces changed as well when being transformed from part residential, part commercial, to opening up a mezzanine on the second floor and a connecting wall between 414 and 412. For workmanship, with the loss of character-defining features, the workmanship of the original townhouses, and even the earlier commercial alterations has been lost. For feeling and association, the multiple changes to the entire building over time has erased the original feeling of the structure and the building associated with early 20th century commerce and the history of the West Broad Street corridor. However, the association with the West Broad Street corridor is lost in part due to the I-16 flyover and the destruction of the area that once existed. Though some of the criteria are met, all the criteria must be met to be considered exceptionally important. As mentioned above, due to the altered and current deteriorating conditions, 414 cannot be considered an exceptional resource that possesses integrity of all of the following: design, location, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. Staff does request the conditions of documenting the building per the MPC policy for documenting buildings. And rather than traditional demolition, the building be deconstructed and the materials salvaged for reuse. So with that, staff recommendation is to approve the demolition request for the building located at 414 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard with the following conditions, because the building otherwise meets the criteria for non-contributing demolition. One, the building must be documented per the MPC policy for documenting buildings, and two, rather than traditional demolition, the building be deconstructed and the materials salvaged for reuse. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Caitlin. Does anybody have any questions for staff? Okay. Thank you.
Actually, I do. Could you just go into a little bit more detail on why it's lost integrity of location because of the flyover?
I'll show you some pictures of some of the setting, of course, is still there, but the location where that portion of Berrien Street has been lost. This was the Union Hotel. This was the Union Hotel across the way. A later Union Hotel was built. So that kind of destroyed a whole part of it, of the street. But the staff report also acknowledges that there is some of the setting intact of that 400 block.
Any additional questions for staff?
I sent some pictures. Why don't we show those too? I did a little bit more research on this area, and
found a couple of interesting pictures. This one in particular, do you want to talk about it?
Or if you want to talk about that now, or do you want to wait until?
I'll just mention that this is another photo to add to the collection of photos that we've looked at from staff. And it gives a little bit of history there regarding the store itself and the one adjacent to it, 412. And then if you want to show the later picture, it was a postcard. So you can see on the right-hand side, this would have been after the alterations took place prior to the demolition of Union Station. Streetcars are still there, which ended about the 40s. Early 40s. So I thought that was pretty surprising to find. So I just wanted everyone to see these as well. Thank you.
And I have one other question for staff. In I know this has been going on for a long time. Has staff yet been inside the building to examine what historic fabric may still be remaining on the interior?
That has not been offered.
Okay. No additional questions for staff? Okay. Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you.
Would the petitioner like to come forward? Make sure you state your name for the record. And remember, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. My comments will be brief. For the record, Harold Yellen on behalf of the petitioner, Halex Holdings, who is the owner of the property, also Shed Architecture and Mr. Shedrick Coleman, who is seated behind me. Also here on behalf of my son, Josh Yellen, who has previously been at this podium but was not available today. So we forgive us, but I'm here to substitute for my son. Procedurally, Caitlin has already explained, or it's certainly in her staff report. This petition was before you on July the 12th and on August the 9th, at which time you continued the petition on both occasions. It came back to you on October the 11th, where the petition before you was to demolish both 412 and 414 as part of one petition. And that was denied. That was the petition, both properties coupled in one petition. What is not readily apparent from staff report or from the presentation is that I think the petitioner, we do bear some responsibility for submitting two buildings in one petition. Hindsight is always 20/20, but that's the only thing that you've had before you is two buildings in one petition. Not surprisingly, when you denied 412 and 414, they were on totally different grounds. They were absolutely unrelated to one another. And not surprisingly, some of you who voted for and some of you who voted against, you have previously expressed your opinion that these properties should be separated. They should be bifurcated and that they should in fact be considered separately. At the August 9th hearing, Mr. Houle and Ms. Taylor and Mr. Becker all expressed a desire to vote separately for each building. And in fact, Mr. Houle made a motion to approve 414 and to deny 412. That was the motion on August the 9th. Prior to actually voting on that motion, the chair she is entitled to do and often does, says, I don't think that motion's in order. I think we should vote for one property at a time. So a new motion was made by Mr. Houle. It was seconded by Ms. Rowan to grant the demo permit for just 414 MLK. And that motion was approved by you 6-1. Literally the seven of you voted 6-1 with only Mr. Higgins voting no. That motion and the impact of that motion lasted about a nanosecond. The chair said, I think I need a ruling. Let's ask Ms. Wilson, did we vote properly? Ms. Wilson said, although I'm not a lawyer, the petition arrived as one petition, so I think we need to consider both buildings at the same time. So rather than voting in that manner, a motion was made to continue it, and that was approved at the August meeting. So I bring you all of this information and the procedural background, because I think there's always been an appetite to bifurcate these properties, to look at them separately. And that's not been done until today, or at least formally until today, where you can actually decide on both properties, but as separate applications. To be clear, we still think that both buildings are non-contributing. We still think that both buildings are eligible for demolition, and we think they're both deserving of your approval. But we also understand, we've listened. In fact, I actually listened to the tape last night and to the minutes, so it's kind of all in my head. We understand your comments and concerns, and we do recognize the need to separate the petitions, which is why we're here again today. So today we ask first that you consider and approve our demolition permit for 414 MLK. And as of this moment, that is the only thing before you. After that vote is taken, then we would ask that you also consider 412, the companion building, and listen to both petitions for the first time. We agree with staff findings in all respects. We're happy to answer any questions you may have. Since I have primarily addressed procedural issues, if I may, excuse me, ask Mr. Coleman to step forward, who perhaps can look more at the substantive issues before you today.
Mm-hmm.
With your permission, Ms. Chairman.
Yep.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Shedrick Coleman, Shed Architecture. I want to again commend staff for what I consider to be a very thorough presentation on the history of the building, with some additional information being presented today that we definitely concur with. We really feel that we presented a strong argument as to why 414 really needs to be removed from the register. The building is not contributing. There is really, when you look at the reasons to make a building contributing or non-contributing, they are all externally related, not based on internal relationship of the building, even though we have provided fair amount of photos and studies on that. So at this stage, unless you have any other questions on 414, I'm here just to answer anything relative to that project.
Does anybody have any questions for the petitioners? Go ahead.
I have a question. If maybe Leah or Caitlin could pull up the report that was done by the contractor,
the structural engineer.
Structural engineer, right. I believe it was under 414. There were some photos that I think it's before that.
This is
right in there. Take a look at picture 27. Okay, right in there. Can we try to get a location on this, where it is in the building?
That's an opening between 414 and 412 that linked the two buildings together. There are a number of those openings, so that's one of those openings.
All right. That was one of my thoughts. And then try 38. That's 27. So go to 38. Sorry. Yeah, it's probably the best way to do it. Okay. Okay. So on the left-hand side of the picture there, that would be, which direction are we facing here?
You're facing the rear. You're facing the rear of the building in this photo, and to the left would be the demising wall between 412 and 414.
Okay, and can we go up one more? Go to 37. One more. Sorry, there's another one in here. Keep going back. There was one that appeared to be the front facade interior facing the front. Facade there. Oh. Not seeing it. Okay. Yeah, go back to 13 there. That looks like the trim of an interior window.
Mm-hmm.
No, 14. There. And yeah,
that has been covered. Okay.
Yeah, well, yes, that is some interior trim. There, interior on the second floor, there are a couple of windows that have some trim left over from the original buildings before they turned into storage up there. So, yes, there are some trim materials in
there. And there were a number of buildings or windows that were enclosed. So there's some evidence there of that.
On one facing, yes, there are some. But those windows also show up. Really, they're not covered over. Those when that trim and where those are show up on the front elevation, and then on the side elevation between 412 and 414, where they built the building up against each other, those were windows before 412 would have been built.
Okay.
They're gone.
Yep. All right. Thank you.
Any additional questions for the applicant or staff?
And if I can speak a little bit more about the materials and the materials over the course of the years have been altered substantially on this building, and so that the integrity or the remaining original materials have been altered and removed mostly on this building. Some of it may remain under the stucco, but where we've had failures and actually pulled some materials off on the exterior, those materials have been damaged or non-existent. And since we've been going through the process of this, we've had one of the awnings collapse, and honestly a little bit concerned about the one that's on MLK now and the integrity of that facade on 414 now, when we've had one that has failed unexpectedly on the building on the Bering Street, that previous Bering Street side. So just to let you know that the structural integrity of that building is questionable for us and of concern.
Okay. Thank you. Is there a member of the public that would like to comment? Make sure you state your name for the record, okay?
Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Jarles, Director of Preservation with Historic Savannah Foundation. HSF believes the petitioner has followed all appropriate procedures and provided all information plus some that is required of them when applying for a demolition of a non-contributing building. We at HSF obviously don't outright support any demolition of any historic building, but we do appreciate the petitioners who go above and beyond in their efforts to follow the procedures before you properly, and as well as providing efforts and spending time and money in preparing the deconstruction instead of demolition of a building of this stature. And we just want to acknowledge these efforts on behalf of the petitioner. HSF would be comfortable with staff's recommendation if that's the route you so choose. And I just wanted to state some warnings of focusing on interior elements of a building like this. This is a district, and your only purview is the exterior of a building. So making any decisions and utilizing statements of interior features would be entirely inappropriate. Even though I love the interior features, that is an inappropriate way to move. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else from the public like to comment? Anybody virtually?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Would the petitioner like to respond to any of the public comments?
Again, Shedrick Coleman, Shed Architecture. We appreciate the comments of the Historic Savannah Foundation and concur with their commentary relative to interior materials. See.
Thank you. Okay. At this time, we will now enter into board discussion, and no further public comment will be accepted. Mr. Becker, I will start with you.
I have no comment at this time.
Ms. Rowan.
I just want to remind everyone that this is a non-contributing building, and it's better to salvage what's inside, because I wouldn't want to walk through there by looking at these photographs. It's crumbling. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Ms. Taylor.
I've got a few comments. I'm going to start with saying that I believe this building, as well as 412, should be considered contributing structures. Based on the ordinance, based on Secretary of Interior standards, classification of resources and criteria for resource designation includes that it meet the period of significance, which is, in our case, 1733 to 1960, and possesses integrity of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association, and meets one or more criteria, including associated with events, that have made a significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history and embody the distinctive characteristics of a type, period, or method of construction. There's two other criteria which these two buildings do not meet, but it does meet these, they do meet these two. I believe them to be culturally and historically significant, and I'll speak directly to 414 here first, but associated with events that have made a significant contribution to the broad pattern of history. This building was occupied by Harry Blumenthal in 1907. And could you pull that one picture up that's got the history below it? That way you can see it visually. He started the store at 414 as a ready-to-wear clothing store. He was born in Poland. He was an immigrant. He was Jewish. He came to the United States, we know, by 1909 because that's when he married. He had four children, including Herbert, who later took over the business. In 1914, the business became B&B Pawn Shop. I did find a license for that. I think it was dated 1910. 1914 became a pawn shop, and then in 1936, it was renamed the B&B Loan Company. So there were several businesses there. The original entrance tile that's in the corner front entry there, if you look on the bottom, does say Harry Blumenthal on it. Harry was a Jewish business owner and part of the West Broad Street Merchants Association. And if you could show that picture. I found this in a book about Jewish businesses in Savannah, and there you can see a large portion of Jewish citizens have been merchants throughout the years. Many of the businesses were on West Broad as well as Broughton and City Market. He is listed there. Harry Blumenthal is listed in this 1928 picture of them. So not only was West Broad Street African-American, predominant, it was also predominant for other minorities and immigrants, of which Harry Blumenthal was part of. Moving on, in 1946, Harry's son Herbert took over and expanded the business, and I think this is when the significant changes occurred in the buildings. He took over 412 West Broad Street and placed the B&B paint at 414. So he separated the businesses at that point, and that's probably when most of the major alterations occurred regarding the exterior. In 1988, Herbert retired. So he operated businesses at these two locations for over 40 years. His father, if you go all the way back to 1907, these businesses have been in the Blumenthal family, owned and operated for over 80 years. I call that culturally, historically significant for our community. These two buildings are linked together by their shared history as well as their connection to the neighborhood. Now, how is the history associated with events that have made significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history? Again, I've mentioned that they have been there 80 years. Also, we have the I-16 flyover that was built in 1960. Many of the buildings were destroyed. Businesses failed. The demo of the Union Street Station, which was directly across the street from these buildings, all were taken down. However, these two buildings survived, and they represent a lost part of Savannah's 20th century commerce. So regarding the criteria met, regarding the distinctive characteristics of a type, period, or method of construction, they also possess integrity of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. These buildings have changed over time. When son Herbert took over in 1946 and expanded into the 412, changes, alterations were taken. The bays on Berrien Street were removed. Windows were covered up. Eaves with brackets were removed. Stucco was applied to the exterior. These alterations are representative of much of the post-World War II construction. And there is a standard, a Secretary of Interior standard that applies here.
and that is that most properties change over time. Those changes that have acquired historic significance in their own right should be retained and preserved. And that's what's being represented here. We're not trying to bring these buildings back or save them because they were built in 1907 and changed dramatically. They have not changed that dramatically since these changes occurred in the late 1940s. And we have pictures to show this. This is the period of time that the buildings currently represent and should be retained and preserved. Regarding the integrity, pulled up a document that has been stated by the Secretary of Interior Standard. It was written in 1988 that talks about integrity. And their statement is, loss of integrity is incremental, and it should not be assumed that because one or even two features that convey significance are extensively damaged or deteriorated, that the building lacks integrity. So there's a two-step process with determining whether a building has integrity or not. Number one, it's identifying the character-defining features. And number two, do they still exist? Here's a few things. The overall shape of the building still exists, except for some alterations that were done in the rear. Projections and recesses. Do these features still exist? At 414, we have still retained the corner recessed entrance with a Blumenthal tiled threshold. The setting and building site, both are still in the original locations, and immediate yard and site remains the same. The windows and doors, and this was the point I was trying to make, unfortunately couldn't find the right photo, with a photo from the inside, had nothing to do with the quality of the inside. It had to do with the fact that a window had been covered. Late 1940s, many windows on the second floor were covered, but do they still exist? There are still two metal windows that are there right now on 414, and it appears that they were there in the 1940s. So it has not changed significantly since the 1940s. The exterior building material is still stucco. Storefronts have been altered. The signs and frieze above the storefront entrance are still in existence. So, in summary, there are enough defining features left to contribute to the overall visual character of the building to make it a contributing structure. I would also like to point out that a few years ago, the 300 block of MLK, which some pictures were shown early of that, won an Excellence in Rehabilitation Award from the Georgia Trust. And there were 9 addresses in that 300 block of MLK. It stated in that award that many of those buildings also had roofs on the verge of collapse, exterior storefronts missing or deteriorated, and had extensive structural damage from neglect over the years, and the facades needed major stabilization. However, as you know now, that 300 block of MLK has been renovated and open for business.
That's all I have to say right now.
Okay. I think you've given us a lot to think about there. Mr. Thompson.
Nan, crazily great job of doing research. However, I'm in a different place on this in that, you know, what the applicant, I don't know when he bought the building, but when the applicant has the building and he looks at it and he says, I followed all the procedures. The plan map shows it non-contributing. And I have plans for my site. There are structural problems all over the place in it. And there have been many alterations over time, although you pointed out things that may still be there. So I have to say that given all what I've heard from others that, you know, I think it's time this corner get rethought out and be the next historic building in the future for MLK Boulevard. And I've been a big supporter of getting rid of the I-16 flyover. So I think our future in that corner could be significantly different with new construction across the street eventually.
Mr. Higgins.
Thank you, Nan, for all your research. I totally agree. Why these buildings were listed as non-contributing is unknown. We can look back, you know, the however many years it was when they did this, and we can all sorts of conjecture, but in my view, there was an error made in not including these 414 as a contributing structure. When I look at the 300 block of MLK as it was 10 years ago, where those facades have been muddled and covered and there's structural problems and all that sort of thing, but yet they were listed as contributing structures. A mistake was made. And I think now we have a chance to rectify that mistake in recommending that this, that 414 Martin Luther King Boulevard be a contributing structure.
Okay. Ms. Gwynn.
I also want to thank Nan for your dedication and your thorough research into this building. I know that a lot of time and resource goes into serving in this capacity, and to go outside of that and do your own research, I think, is commendable. Unfortunately, I find myself on the other side of this issue. With it being a non-contributing structure and reviewing the structural reports on what the experts say can be done to salvage what is left, I'd fail to see a compelling reason to go against that. And I do appreciate the petitioner's willingness to save what is salvageable for future reuse and whatever goes in that base in the future.
Mr. Hull.
I think that whatever the vote is, it's not going to be unanimous. Nan, that was a heck of a research that you did. My concerns are that there was an action taken years ago. For some reason, it wasn't explained, that the majority of a group of folks here in the city said this is not a contributing building. I don't know why, but the decision was made and it hasn't been canceled. So I unfortunately lean toward agreeing with the staff's recommendation, even though I'm whispering my support.
Okay, we'll go around a second time. Mr. Becker.
I have no additional comments.
Ms. Rowan.
I agree with staff's recommendations.
Ms. Taylor.
I agree. I don't understand why it had been determined non-contributing, but I think it's got to stop now. I think this is our opportunity to stop and to stop any more demolitions moving forward. In compliance with the National Park Service concern, with us being on the threatened list, we don't need to be taking demolitions lightly, particularly in this area that we're trying to preserve and do away with the flyover. Is all the more reason why the last remaining buildings closest to the flyover should remain. And I would like to point out again that the 300 block of MLK has been renovated, and a lot of those buildings were in the same situation prior to their rehabilitation.
Mr. Thompson.
I appreciate Nan's and your point of view, and I still am supportive of staff recommendation.
Mr. Higgins.
A couple of comments. I was mentioned by Mr. Charles about the interior review. We have not been looking at this to use the interior review as anything. We use it as evidence of what still exists of the historic integrity of the building overall. As to the structural peril that seems to be pointed out in the 300 block, the northernmost building, I think it has an ocean center or something in it now, I remember when that was being renovated, they literally built a structure to hold up the second floor because the first floor was so unstable. They built the structure, they restored it, it can be done. When you look at where they stripped the facade and found the glass signage for the clothing store, mm-hmm. the 300 block, and then when I look at where the awning has come down as part of the staff research, we see the original transom windows still exist. There is historic fabric remaining in this building, and I still strongly believe that they should be considered contributing. And with that, we would then review it under a different set of criteria for demolition.
Ms. Gwynn?
Nothing further.
Mr. Hull?
Nothing further.
Okay. At this time, we will now entertain a motion.
Rowan, I move that the Downtown Historic Board of Review approve the petition 2300545 COA 114 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, provided that the conditions outlined in staff recommendations are met.
Do I have a second? What?
Was there a second?
No.
Thompson's second. Yeah.
Okay. Current motion on the floor is to approve with the following conditions as outlined in the staff recommendation report, seconded by Mr. Thompson. Mr. Becker, how do you vote?
No.
Ms. Rowan?
Aye.
Mr. Thompson, or Ms. Taylor, sorry.
No.
Mr. Thompson?
Aye.
Mr. Higgins?
No.
Ms. Gwynn?
Aye.
And Mr. Hull?
Aye.
Okay. With that, the petition has been approved with conditions. It's extremely disappointing. Next is the petition of Shed Architecture 23-005414-COA 412 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, non-contributing demolition. You wanna, can we, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, this is Caitlin again. The applicant is requesting approval to demolish the non-contributing building at 412 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The exact date of construction for this building is unknown, but it was likely built in the early 1900s. Make sure I have the right one. Okay. It's listed as a non-contributing resource. The Sanborn Fire Insurance map from 1888 shows a two-story wood frame dwelling at the approximate site of 412. By 1898, 412 West Broad Street is still a two-story wood-frame dwelling, but with some alterations at the rear. 1916 Sanborn map shows a three-story masonry store on this lot, which may be what is seen today. At some point between 1953 and 1973, 412 was adjoined with the neighboring building 414, as can be seen on the maps. The 1916 Savannah City Directory notes an L. Mirsky at 412 West Broad Street and a Mrs. E.B. Novak at 412 and a half West Broad Street. A photograph from the 1940s shows a sign on the building. Let me just blow that up a little. A sign on the building for dry goods, shoes, and luggage shop with the name Eisenman, who was the successor to Mercy. At a later date, the building was acquired by the Blumenthals to become part of the B&B Loan and Pawn Shop. The Savannah Ward Notebook has a note to omit 412 West Broad Street, but a reason is not given. This page does not include much detail about the structure, except to note that it has a vague construction date of 20th century, much like 414. In 2011, a COA was issued to repair and paint the stucco and window frames and add a new awning. and install the gooseneck lamps that are still seen on the building today. No information was noted about the original form of the building, but at that time, staff noted the building was listed as non-contributing due to the exterior alterations resulting in a loss of integrity. This is just some slightly more modern changes with the condition before there was a change, just to show. I won't go through the historic building map background again because it's exactly the same. Just to say that, you know, in that April 2000 survey, when buildings in the 400 block were considered, this building was not one of them. With regard to the criteria for contributing status, again, it's the criteria to become contributing if it's non-contributing, and then to also meet all of the exterior or exceptional importance criteria. So a reason for the lack of inclusion as contributing has not been, as non-contributing has not been discovered, but we have at least one survey from 1994, and doesn't really lean towards either. But a structural report was conducted for 412 MLK on August 21st, 2023. The structural engineer found that due to capacity conditions, 412 should also be demolished and rebuilt. Interior photographs show that it is in better condition than 414, but its condition does not change the fact that it was determined to be non-contributing. The distinctive exterior characteristics of this building have largely been lost based upon what is seen in older photographs compared to the present day. We go back up. This, I believe, is sometime in the 1940s. The front facade of 412 has been altered heavily. The archway, the double windows, the step parapet wall are some of the things that have been changed to what we see today. Again, with exceptional importance, it needs to meet all of the following: location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. And the building, though it's associated with the early 20th century commerce and the history of the West Broad Street corridor, this doesn't meet all of, like, the workmanship, loss of character defining features. It's been lost, in the sense that the portion of the 400 block between 402 and 414 MLK is in the same configuration and order. This aspect does still have integrity, but the integrity of the design was destroyed when the original storefront, the archway windows, and I don't know if this is columns or whatever was holding this, supporting this. None of this is there. That's new storefront. That's much more modern aluminum type of storefront is now in its place. Although some of the criteria are met, all the criteria must be met to be considered exceptionally important. As mentioned above, due to the altered and current conditions, 412 cannot be considered an exceptional importance that possesses integrity of design, location, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. Staff also has the same conditions to document per the MPC policy for documenting buildings, and rather than traditional demolition, to deconstruct and salvage the materials. So with that, staff recommendation is to approve the demolition request for the building at 412 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard with the following conditions, because the building otherwise meets the criteria for non-contributing demolition. One, the building must be documented per the MPC policy for documenting buildings. And two, rather than traditional demolition, the building be deconstructed and the materials salvaged for reuse. Thanks. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Caitlin. Does anybody have any questions for staff? Go ahead.
Can you go back to the information, or maybe I'm probably going to ask the petitioner also, but for 412, was there a study done that said that the building was not, 412 was not structurally stable and was about to fall down.
I think what this, I'm not a structural engineer, but from what I can gather from this, it's basically saying because there's no interior load bearing walls on this, the framing system is compromised, and it just seems like I'm not going to act like I know what I'm talking about with this, but it is provided.
I'll hold my question for the petitioner. Thank you.
Any other questions for staff? Cool. Thank you, Caitlin. Would the petitioner please come forward? Make sure you state your name for the record.
Thank you, Harold Yellen, for the petitioner. Once again, I'd like to address a procedural point and then have Shedrick Coleman come forward. It seems to be true that when we stand before you, the last thing we always say is, do you have any questions or comments? And what we're finding is after we sit down and we can't talk anymore, we hear things from the podium that we'd love to address. And in particular, Ms. Taylor did an outstanding job of her historical research. And I would love to have heard that during our discussion because I'm the only person in this room that called Herbert Blumenthal Uncle Herbie. And I'm the only person in this room that calls his 95-year-old wife Aunt Esther. My father and his wife double dated for the first time with Herbie and Esther Blumenthal. Our families go back that long. So I would love to have heard that because what we did, knowing that Herbie Blumenthal passed away years ago, that his wife is ailing in 95, I know his oldest son. I called Harvey Blumenthal, who we laugh at Harvey because he says he works for the Secretary of State. We all know he really works for the CIA, but it's been a joke for years. He just does research. Called him, and I said, what is the historical significance of this building? And his comment was, what are you talking about? And I said, well, we're going in front of the Historic Review Board. Has this building ever been associated with any kind of historic event? And he said, selling paint is what we did. We had a loan company. We did not associate with an event. And I said, was there any historical person that came in the door? Like, you know, Jimmy Carter stood on the bar. I think he masters and announced his presidency. And he said, absolutely not. And so he signed an affidavit, which is a part of the record saying, and Ms. Oskar, I don't know why you're shaking your head any more than you made a comment at the end of the last petition. We're here. And as you vote, and that's the vote of the board. So I would prefer to be able to stand before you and have an honest audience. So having said that, I did reach out to Harvey Blumenthal, the oldest son of Herbert Blumenthal, and the affidavit is before you. I also did research, and I looked at the National Park Service and the National Register, and it specifically says that mere association with historic events is not enough. Association is the direct link between a historic property and an important historic event or an important historic person. Neither of those is true here. As to materials, the guidelines say the property must retain key exterior materials dating from the period of its historic significance, and it does not. If the property was previously rehabilitated, historic materials and significant features must have been preserved. They were not. Cannot be a recreation. It has to be a rehabilitation. Something fabricated to look historic is not eligible for the National Register, where historic features are lost and where historic materials have been lost. That's the part that I would have added. I would ask that if there are any questions of the petitioner, we're here to answer any and all questions. And sometimes the procedure at this board, unlike other boards, doesn't allow us a full and frank discussion. So with that, we do support the recommendation of the HDBR staff. And I'll call on Mr. Coleman, because I know that there's at least one question from Mr. Poole that I simply cannot answer. Mr. Coleman.
Again, Shedrick Coleman, Shed Architecture. You know, a lot's been thrown out here today on these projects. And, you know, I've sat for 6 years on the Georgia National Historic Review Board and chaired that board for three of those years. And I have a very deep understanding and respect for historic properties and an understanding of what it means to review those properties and to appreciate how over the course of time those properties are modified and whether they're relevant to move forward with them. It is not something to be taken lightly by myself or anyone who is undertaking any sort of project of this type. These buildings have been inexorably changed and modified over the course of time. Yes, they may maintain one or two elements that are historic. At 412, we did a invasive study of the exterior and interior of these walls to see what was remaining behind them. On exterior, the materials are gone. On the interior, all the window openings have been infilled to where they're in their original shapes really cannot be distinguished adequately or restored because they've been blocked in. So the building does not maintain any character that can be moved forward and saved to make it in any way a historic structure. I believe that is why it has not been noted as contributing. From a standpoint of historical significance, Savannah is my home. I've grown up here. I've had family who have had businesses on MLK south of the overpass, where a lot of these buildings that contain historical offices for the Black community especially have been demolished and are gone. This building was not a part of that. The late W.W. Law, who was a preeminent Black scholar here in this community, did an exhaustive study of the architecture and the significance of the buildings in this community to the Black community and created a publication that was based on that and was used as a basis of even a tour that was established over time. It's not been a hidden fact of what the condition of these buildings have been. Speaking of the structural condition of what has happened in the 300 block versus these buildings, we're talking totally different buildings, totally different structural systems. The engineer that we had study 414 is the engineer who did the structural engineering for the 300 block buildings. He understood exactly what those buildings were and was able to compare what those buildings were to what 412's condition is. And he and I had a discussion on those as we went through it. It's none of the determinations that have been done by myself or any other professional in this undertaking has been taken cavalierly or lightly with regard to the saving of these buildings. My client did not want to demolish any of these buildings. It's never been his intent until it was determined that saving these buildings was beyond the capability for him to do it safely. So we would like to have 412 considered for the merits of what we've done to try and answer all the questions of the board, the exhaustive studies that have been undertaken by staff, by the professionals my client has hired, and for you to take a look at this petition from the standpoint of what the ordinance outlines for consideration. And if you have any other questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Does anybody have any questions for the petitioners?
I do.
Go ahead, Mr. Hall.
The previous question about understood that the study that I saw really said that 414 was not salvageable, but I didn't see anything about the structural integrity for 412.
At the last petition, last presentation, I went over the structural study for 412, and the determination of 412 is that it is not in any imminent danger of collapse at this time. The condition was for any new use of that building, which we would undertake, the structural system of that building is inadequate to support any of the current building loads that will be required to occupy the building. That was the reason why the engineer determined that the structural systems could not be utilized for future use in the building. It is not based on danger of collapse. It is basically that you could not use it and it would all have to be replaced anyway. It's a 24-foot wide building and the structure is not adequate without either additional support, which is not reasonable inside a 24-foot wide building, or a total rebuilding of it.
Does that answer your question? Yeah. Does anybody else have any other questions for the petitioner? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Is there a member of the public that would like to comment?
Hello, my name is Andrew Berrien-Jones, chair of the Oglethorpe Plan Coalition, and I thank Ms. Taylor for her research. I enjoyed that photograph of the Merchants Association. My great grandfather, Peter Meldrum, is the fifth person from the right. He was a mayor and a judge for many years. I'm speaking on a procedural concern. When a non-contributing building is proposed to be demolished, my understanding is that the MPC is required to reevaluate it, and it comes to you for a de novo reevaluation of the building from scratch to see whether or not it should be treated as a contributing structure. And the reason I say that, I know a number of you know that already, but I was hearing comments in the prior with respect to the other building that the fact that it was a non-contributing building or that determination was made in the past was a factor. It shouldn't be a factor. And so I'm very concerned about the decision that you made on the other property, because it does appear that some individuals on the board thought that because the decision was made in the past that it should not be contributing, that that should be a factor that would weigh into your new decision to start from scratch to see whether or not the building was contributing. So obviously, Leah and others can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that you wouldn't even have this issue except for the fact that when a non-contributing building is proposed to be demolished, there's a special process and you're following that process. So the fact that it's non-contributing itself should not be the consideration that makes you determine that it's non-contributing. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else from the public like to comment?
Ryan Charles, Director of Preservation for HSF. I'm going to use my time inappropriately. I have no additional comments for this petition. I just wanted to state that HSF would like to thank Leah Mihalik for all of the work she's done for the entire city of Savannah, for this board specifically, for me as my ex-boss, and thank you, Leah.
Does anybody does anybody else have any public comments in relation to this project? Anybody virtually?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Would the petitioner like to respond to the public comments?
Yes, Shedrick Coleman. In reference to the public comment, the process in which he questions is exactly what has happened. The process has not been about that it's been non-contributing before. We understood that the process engaged would involve staff taking a totally fresh look at these buildings. It's very clear that they went through a lot of work to try and determine whether there need to be a change of status based on the history of these buildings. So the process of reevaluating the buildings for their contributing status has been achieved. And if I could add one more thing relative to the report from NSF that talked about demolition, it was not that no buildings could be demolished, but it was about buildings that would affect the character of the trust lot, the tithing lot, squares and streets and lanes. And one of the most important things that they saw was also the reestablishment of the street pattern. One of the things that we're talking about in our project is trying to make sure that our future project helps to reestablish the Berrien Street corridor that was lost. So not only are we trying to, you know, improve a portion of the physical fabric from an architectural standpoint, we also see the importance of what we can do to restore the street pattern in Savannah, with my client being a prominent member of the coalition to remove the flyover. So we are partners with the historic district and what we'd like to see happen with this project. With that, I'll leave.
Okay, thank you. At this time, we'll now enter into board discussion and no further public comment will be accepted. Mr. Houle, I'll start with you.
I'll hold comments for this round.
Okay. Ms. Squinn?
No comments.
Mr. Higgins?
Still my belief that this should be considered as a contributing building. I would like to mention that I'm disappointed. I understand that staff would have to go inside the building at the invitation of the owner, but when we hear that they have taken their own review and for staff not to have taken part in that to help the determination of contributing versus non-contributing, I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Thompson. You. Yes.
I support the staff recommendation and the work they did to consider this non-conforming building as possibly eligible to be listed. But and the context of my comment regarding non-conforming is that the owner has this property and he's looking at it, and the map says it's non-conforming or not.
Non-contributing.
What's the phrase? You know it, don't you?
Non-contributing.
Non-contributing. Then that's where he started from. So the rest of us came from that. But again, I'm supportive of staff recommendation.
Okay, Ms. Taylor.
I'm not going to go through the whole thing again, but I did want to mention that the research that I did is basically the research that would have been done to determine whether or not these two buildings were contributing or non-contributing. So there was a purpose for it. It wasn't just a nice story. So there was a lot of substance in that, and I wish that it would have been, taken, I guess, for what it was, and the fact, the argument being that they should be contributing buildings. I guess I have nothing else to say at this point.
Ms. Rowan.
I just want to commend the staff and Nan for all the research that all of you have done. I know all of you have put a lot of hard work into it, and I thank you.
Mr. Becker.
I think Ms. Taylor's research that she has done makes the case that these should be contributing buildings, or this 412 should be a contributing building, and that's my position on the matter.
Okay, we'll go around a second time. Mr. Houle?
No comment.
Ms. Gwynn?
No comment.
Mr. Higgins?
I echo what Nan said.
Okay. Mr. Thompson?
No comment.
Okay. Ms. Taylor?
No more comment.
Okay. Ms. Rowan?
No comment.
And Mr. Becker?
No comment.
Okay. At this time, we will now entertain a motion.
Thompson.
Yes.
The Savannah Historic District Board of Review recommends that the demolition request for a building located at 412 Martin Luther King Jr. I guess I need a little bit more than that at the top. If you can scroll that down.
What?
No, that's not even there. There, for file number, 23-005414, COA, and including the staff, conditions 1 and 2, because it otherwise meets the criteria for non-contributing demolition. Did I get enough of the words in there? Sorry, I need a script.
No, you're fine. There's a script in the binders that we got. So the current motion on the floor is to, made by Mr. Thompson, is to approve, with the conditions as outlined in the staff recommendation report. Do I have a second?
Rowan, second.
Okay. Mr. Becker, how do you vote?
No.
Ms. Rowan?
Aye.
Ms. Taylor?
No.
Mr. Thompson?
Aye.
Mr. Higgins?
No.
Ms. Gwynn?
Aye.
And Mr. Houle?
No.
Okay. The motion fails. Right? Yeah.
That wasn't
time. Yeah. Yeah. So the motion fails. So I need another motion, please.
What was the vote number?
4-3. So the motion failed. So I need another motion, please.
I need a number.
A number for the...
Yeah. So I move that the Historic Board of Review deny the demolition of... Sorry, I need the application, the number. Yeah, sorry. File number 23-005414 COA 412 MLK to deny the demolition and...
Because?
To deny the demolition because the property is associated with events that have a significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history and embodies the distinctive characteristics of a type, period, or method of construction or that represents the master of the work of a master. And because the property possesses integrity of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association.
Okay.
And I don't know if this needs to be included with that motion or not. This is where I need help procedurally. May I make a recommendation to have a application filed for it to be a contributing structure? Does that need to be included on this motion or a separate motion?
It's fine.
Yes, it needs to be included in this motion.
It's fine, yeah.
That I include the fact that it should have an application to be considered a contributing structure.
Okay. I will repeat that before we do a second. So Ms. Taylor has made a motion on the floor to deny the application due to the fact that the property meets the contributing building criteria and recommends that an application to become a contributing building be completed. Do I have a second?
Higgins, second.
Okay. Mr. Becker, how do you vote?
Aye.
Ms. Rowan?
Nay.
Ms. Taylor?
Aye.
Mr. Thompson?
Nay.
Mr. Higgins?
Aye.
Ms. Gwynn?
No.
And Mr. Houle?
Aye.
Okay. With that, the motion has passed. Okay. Next item on the agenda is the approved staff reviews. They've been attached to your agenda, and I will read them now for the record, and then we'll vote for acknowledgement. The petition of Trey Flood, 23-005375-COA, 226 West Broughton Street, awning sign. The petition of Fast Signs, 23-005018-COA, 128 East Broughton Street, projecting sign, refacings 2. And lastly, the petition of Steve Bodek, 23-0055-6980-COA, 610 Howard Street, repaint exterior and roof repair. Vote for acknowledgement, please say aye.
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 The next two items are work performed without a COA, and then there's also the report of items that were just deferred to staff for the month of November. Notices, proclamations, and acknowledgments. There's a November report on the inspections and also on the stamped drawings. Under other business, Ms. Bridget Liddy is here to give us a presentation on the subdivision revisions that I requested of over a year ago. So she is going to give us a presentation about the status of that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question with regard to one of the items that we just went over, which is the work done without appropriateness?
Yes.
And this would be more so for staff. How long can these go on? I'm talking specifically about 222 East Gwinnett Street, the building of the staircase where
they'll go on as long as code compliance lets it. I mean.
So it's all on code compliance?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, they'll eventually subpoena them if they haven't already, but then, you know, the judge can continue that many, many times as well until the person shows up. So.
Does that answer your question? Unfortunately. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Miss.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the commission. My name is Bridget Liddy, and I work for Planning and Urban Design with the City of Savannah. I'm here with you today to talk about an amendment, or amendments, plural, that we're making to two of our ordinances that pertain to subdivision and recombination of parcels in the historic district. This came out of a letter that was written by the chairwoman, specifically addressing the need for more transparency as we move forward with looking at these types of requests coming through, making sure that there is a public notification process, standards that could be used for having a COA associated with the recombination or subdivision of lots and parcels in the downtown, and providing greater transparency for residents to know. So as we moved forward with this process more than a year ago, we did pull together a group of stakeholders, and many of these individuals are here today with us, to kind of get in the weeds and try to figure out what we could do as far as making adjustments to the ordinance. So the first portion that would need to change has to do with our subdivision ordinance. There's a section that deals specifically with design standards. That talks a lot about preservation and other unique features of a parcel. One of the items that we are adding, as outlined in the presentation in front of you, is the subdivision or recombination of a property within the Savannah Downtown Historic Overlay District shall require a COA, as provided in Section 319 of the Zoning Ordinance. We have to have this referenced in the subdivision ordinance in order to connect it to the zoning ordinance, specifically the overlay pertaining to downtown. To let you all know, currently the way the public notification process is set up, it's in Article 3 of our zoning ordinance. With that, there is a line item, I don't know if you can read it because it is kind of small, that says certificate of appropriateness with a red arrow pointing to it. As part of the COA process, public notification requires a posted sign. So what we're talking about is any kind of subdivision or recombination that occurs would have to have a sign posted on the property to comply with the COA requirements for public notification. In order to do that, we need to go ahead and make some adjustments to Article 3, specifically Article 319.2, which talks about applicability for certificates of appropriateness. We would actually be adding a line item to that saying subdivision or recombination of a parcel, lot, or tract as it relates to the obtaining of a COA. And then fast-forwarding to Article 7, which you all are very familiar with, we would also make some adjustments for that when it comes to the criteria for the COA, specifically adding a line item there for subdivision and recombination standards. As we move forward to further in the code to 7, 8, 12, we would go ahead and make some adjustments to have two standards that would be used when reviewing subdivisions coming to you all. The first one is that the subdivision or recombination of lots shall be consistent with the prevailing historic context and lot patterns within the visually related context, including but not limited to lot size, lot shape, and lot configurations. The second item on the list is contributing resources on the same parcel shall not be subdivided. Just to provide you with the context, we did provide definitions for historic context and visually related on that slide. And then there would just be adjustments to the numbering at the tail end of the ordinance to ensure that everything syncs up numerically. And our goal with this process, we're here to provide this information to you all as a courtesy, and we plan to go ahead and move forward with going to the city council in early December. Their first meeting is actually December 17th next month. With that, I'm here to entertain any questions that you might have. One thing that I will say is that if an individual is denied for any reason for getting a COA for the request, that process is outlined in the ordinance where they can go to the Zoning Board of Appeals to look to appeal that decision. So with that, if you have any questions, please let me know.
Thank you.
Sure.
So this, just as to add more information, we've gone over this, like Bridget said, with multiple stakeholders and tried to figure out language and things like that. So this is where we've kind of ended up, where everybody is on the same terms and everybody agrees. But obviously, if you have questions or comments or anything that you'd like to ask Ms. Liddy, please feel free.
Thank you. First of all, very good presentation. I'd just like you to back up the slides. It went by about the Historic Review Board back a ways, probably in the middle of your presentation somewhere. Keep going.
You know what slide number it is?
That's the first one?
The first one?
Go up some more. Oh, wait a minute. I don't know.
What's your question?
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, my question isn't anything. My question is, can I see the one I went by fast?
Oh, okay.
So I can't remember which one it was without studying it a bit. Oh, forget it.
So basically the synopsis is that anytime somebody would apply to subdivide or combine their lots, it would come before this board. So that way we can ensure that more damage happens to the overboard plan.
Like we did today or whatever. Okay.
Yeah. So it comes before us. And the main thought is that we're trying to keep the integrity of the Oglethorpe plan intact. And that's the.
Right. Yeah. I was here when that whole thing blew up originally lately last year.
Exactly.
Anyway, good job.
And this is only, just to clarify, this is only applicable to the downtown historic district.
Right.
This is, whenever I go in and look at changing ordinances or modifying ordinances, I don't go full vigor. This is our first attempt. It might be that it gets tweaked later on down the road as we move forward, but this is our first attempt to put a pin to address this issue.
Does anybody else have any questions for Ms. Liddy? No. Thank you.
Thanks.
Considering we have other stakeholders here, if you would like to make comments, you can make comments just so that it's in the record, but at this point, the document is what it is, and it's going to go to City Council. But I felt since you guys were here and you showed up, if you would like to make comments, you feel free to do so. Just make sure you state your name for the record.
Certainly. My name is Andrew
Jones. And try to keep it to 5 minutes or less.
Chair. I promise. Chair of the Oglethorpe Plan Coalition, and we support this proposal as a very important first step. We believe that there are other details that also need to be addressed and ironed out, but they can wait until after this first step is accomplished and finalized. So thank you.
Hello again. My name is Steve Edwards. I represent the Downtown Neighborhood Association, and we support the proposal. Again, it's not perfect, but we like it as it is and support it in its current form.
Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
Ryan Jarls with the Historic Savannah Foundation. I agree with the previous two comments. Thank you.
Does anybody else have anything else they'd like to say before we move on to the next thing? No. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the nominating committee to present nominations. So just as a point of clarification, I thought that my term ended next month, and it does not. As far as like my board position. So my board position is not up until the end of next year. I have been chair for a year, and chair terms are a year long. So I guess I'm saying that I'm willing to be chair again. But I know that we had a nominating committee put together, so I'll let Nan talk about what they put together.
Okay. Nominating committee was Mr. Becker and Mr. Thompson and myself, and we are presenting this slate to be President Ellie. Again?
Chair,
excuse me. I keep calling him president.
Call me president. And I'm like, I'll take it, but you know.
Right. Chair right. Ellie and vice chairperson being Karen Gwent.
So basically same positions as we have now.
Correct.
So next month is the month that we will vote. So just keep that in mind. Okay. So the last thing I'm going to say, even though Ryan kind of stole my thunder earlier, is I was going to thank Leah for her 11 years, right? 11 years of being here at the MPC. This is her last meeting with us as staff, which makes me sad. But I'm sure she's happy to join a new venture, to go on do other things, take some time for herself and her family. So, y'all just make sure you express your, congratulations, I guess, and support,
and thankfulness to her and her duty that she's done for us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And so the next pre-meeting is Wednesday, December 13th, here in this room, obviously at noon, and then regular meeting starts at 1.
Excuse me, if I may.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, everybody. Melanie Wilson, hey. Executive Director. Just wanted to take a moment also to let you know that we are doing a nice reception for Leah on the 15th from 2 until 4. We'll have very heavy hors d'oeuvres, so come a little hungry. To thank her for her years of service with MPC. I think she started in, 2012 or something like that. So she's done a great job for us, and she will be missed, but I'm sure that we will be seeing her. So wanted to make sure that you know that. Please put it on your calendars. We will be sending out invites to the other boards, and hopefully people will be able to come by and wish her well. Cool.
Thank you for that. Does anybody have anything else?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
I just – from the past couple of meetings with, I know we've had some kind of complicated motions and some complicated issues. And I've asked, Melanie and staff, to make sure that everyone has these notebooks so that they can review both procedures, the ordinance and the Secretary of the Interior standards. I know when my class of board members were appointed, we didn't really have formal training, and we weren't given a copy of this. And I think that that's pretty imperative. So I would urge all of us, to do some independent research and spend some time looking through them so that you understand, the purview of this position and what guides, the decisions that need to be made. And I have also asked her, not that I'm signing us up for additional time or commitment, but I do think it's useful for us to have some ongoing training as issues become more complex.
Yes.
And so hopefully they'll provide some opportunities, and I would urge all of us to sign ourselves up for those training opportunities.
Yes. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I have to concur on that. I think that's extremely important, and also including the Secretary of Interior standards, which our ordinance and design guidelines are based on. And I think having a really good understanding of those 10 standards is essential, and I'm not sure how much that's reviewed. It's kind of disguised in our design guidelines, but I would definitely include that as well.
And another thing, too, just to feed off of what everybody else is saying, if you do review things and you have questions, obviously feel free to ask. And then if you do feel like you need additional training, like in person where we all kind of do this and we talk, kind of like pre-meeting except a training, just let us know, let staff know, and we can figure that out. Anything else to add? Go ahead. No, it's you.
Well, I give my praise to Leah for her work here. 11 years. I was trying to figure that out earlier. Congratulations on where you're headed next, and I'm sure you'll be much appreciated. I just, maybe this is for Bree. I think when I got on the board, you emailed me the documents in an electronic form. I went looking for it while I was sitting here and I couldn't find it. Can you re-send that electronic form? I use that more than anything these days in paper. So thank you.
I send it to everyone, but I can resend it. Not a problem.
Okay. Thank you, Bree.
If I may, the other thing that we're going to do so that can at least eliminate somewhat killing the trees is to give you all a jump drive with all of this information on it so that you can always have it.
Right.
But I just want to reiterate to you all, you know, we set up training when you all first got appointed.
Yeah.
They went over all of this information that Karen is bringing up right now. We hand out information with this stuff on there. We're going to get some of this information laminated and put at your set seats for every meeting so that you have how to make a motion. You've got some of the standard information to make sure that you're looking at it, and that, you know, everybody's kind of staying within their lane. I do think it's important that, you all remember that, you know, the job, as you know, is to do the reviews and make sure that we're staying within policy. A lot of times we have personal, views, and that sounds great, but you know, at the end of the day, you kind of have to take a step back and look at what those standards are and, just the overall everything. So, thank you guys. Thank you for what you do. This is not an easy job. It's probably one of the toughest boards to have to sit on. So I do appreciate everything that you're doing.
Okay. Anything else? No. Okay. Meeting adjourned.